entropy hypothesis, which is one of a number of linked hypotheses governing n categories, meaning things that are a bit too vague at present to be really live up to the name of a conjecture, because they're saying that two things are the same, but neither of those things has been completely defined yet. But there's a lot of evidence for these hypotheses, and hopefully trying to make them more precise and prove them will help us understand a lot about n categories. So the homotopy hypothesis is the simplest of these, so that's the one I want to talk about here. There are lots of references at this website here, references to online work and also some older work that's not available online. So n-category theory is really based on a beautiful big idea, which is that besides things and processes that go between things, we should also think about processes or meta-processes that go between processes, and so on, meta-meta-processes and so on ad infinitum. And the idea of an n-category is to try to formalize this, describe what kind of operations you should be allowed to use to combine processes, meta-processes, and so on, and what kind of laws they should satisfy. So it's a very general idea, and at first glance, it doesn't really have more to do with topology than with any other subject that might involve processes. However, the homotopy hypothesis reveals otherwise, and the idea is simple. It's just that if you have a point in a topological space, that's a classic example of a thing. If you have a path in a topological space, that's a classic example of a process. So, for example, when you walked here this morning from your hotel, that was a classic example of a process, and the point was a path in a topological space. A homotopy between paths is a classic example of a metaprocess, and really that is a truly classic example, meaning that it's a little bit hard to list 20 different examples of metaprocesses compared to how easy it is to list these things and processes. But if you decide tomorrow to take a shortcut, that's a meta-process, a change in paths. Of course, homotopy needs to be a continuous change in paths. And so what that means is that whenever you have any topological space, say X, you should get an infinity category out of it. And it's a beautiful idea because it amounts to using this space as a blackboard on which you draw diagrams. So whenever an n-category theorist is drawing diagrams on a blackboard, that's the topological space. That rectangle there is the topological space in which from which he's constructing a infinity category, but you could do it with any topological space, and so any topological space should give rise to an infinity category called the fundamental infinity groupoid of X. It's called an infinity groupoid because, at least heuristically speaking, all these paths and homotopies and so on have inverses. You can go back along any path, you can go back along any homotopy, and so on. Of course, these are inverses in the weak sense. Staying home all day is not the same as walking to the Fields Institute and then walking back. They're not equal to each other, those two paths, but there's a homotopy between them, so they're equivalent. So the idea is that an infinity groupoid should, if we formalize it correctly, be an infinity category where every morphism has an inverse up to equivalence. Oh, but what's an equivalence? Well, it's a morphism that has an inverse up to equivalence. So there's a kind of recursive definition going up into the sky there of what it means for a n morphism to have a weak inverse. And that's part of what's a little tricky about infinity groupoids, but we have a source of examples of them, one from any topological space, and so it's our job really just to figure out the correct formalization of that idea. And so the homotopy hypothesis asks, are these examples of infinity groupoids all the examples, or essentially all the examples? Or in other words, to what extent are spaces just the same thing as infinity groupoids. Are there lots of infinity groupoids out there that don't come, that aren't even equivalent to ones that come from spaces or not? So let's warm up to this. This is a question whose affirmative answer was conjectured by Grothendieck in his big fat letter to Quillen. But let's warm up with something where we just look at ordinary one groupoids, ordinary groupoids, because this takes us way back to the prehistory of algebraic topology. At least there they were thinking about things in terms of the fundamental group of a space, but in retrospect, we can think just as easily about the fundamental groupoid of a space. So from any space, we can try to just build a plain old category whose objects are points and whose morphisms are paths in that space. Of course, that doesn't really work because composition of paths isn't strictly associative unless you play some sneaky trick like using so-called Moore paths. And even if you play that particular sneaky trick, these paths won't have inverses strictly. They'll just have inverses up to homotopy. So what people usually do, if they're just trying to get a category out of a space, is to work with equivalence classes of paths. So maybe later Schreiber will talk about some other kind of equivalence class you can take. But in algebraic topology, the classic thing to do is to use homotopy classes. And then you get a groupoid called the fundamental groupoid of your space, pi 1, capital pi 1 of x. So you can turn spaces into groupoids, but it's better than that. You can turn maps between spaces into functors between groupoids in an obvious way. Any path gets sent over to a path, and so any homotopy class gets sent over to a homotopy class. But it's even better than that. You can look at homotopies between homotopies, and that should give you a two category. Well, again, we're doing a kind of cutoff here. We're looking at spaces, maps, homotopies between maps. You should go on forever and look at homotopies between homotopies and so on. But since we're cutting off at the second level, we need to take equivalence classes of homotopies. So we work with homotopy classes of homotopies to get a two-category top, a two-category version of top. And those two morphisms, the homotopy classes of homotopies, they'll get sent over to natural transformations between functors, between groupoids. So there's this nice two-functor from the two-category version of top to the two-category of groupoids, and that is something that really mathematically exists. So you can ask, to what extent does this reveal that top and groupoid are the same? If this were an equivalence of some sort, then we'd say they were the same. So to study that, of course, it would be nice to see if we can go back, get spaces from groupoids. And this is what Eilenberg and McLean did. They did it originally for groups, but it's no harder to do it for groupoids. So I'll just call this construction of a space from a groupoid the Eilenberg-McLean space of the groupoid, and I'll write it as G with our groupoid G with some bars around it, because some other name for it would be the geometric realization of the nerve of the groupoid, and at least geometric realization is often written with those bars. But anyway, all of these fancy names make the construction sound infinitely more terrifying than it actually is. It could be explained to anyone in kindergarten before they can even pronounce Eilenberg-McLean. So the idea is, for each object in your groupoid, you draw a dot. For each morphism, you draw an arrow. That's not hard to think of, because a morphism just is an arrow. Whenever you have a pair of morphisms that are composable, you get another morphism, and there, lo and behold, you have a triangle. So you stick in a triangle for each composable pair of morphisms, and so on. For any composable triple of morphisms, you get a tetrahedron. And so you just get this simplicial set from a groupoid, but then you view it as a space, you geometrically realize it, and that will be the Eilenberg-McLean space of the groupoid. So again, we're doing this trick of taking the diagrams that N category theorists like to draw and taking them too seriously, quote unquote. We're taking them as really being a space. So here, instead of taking the blackboard, drawing all possible diagrams on it, and getting an infinity groupoid, we're taking our infinity groupoid, drawing all possible simplices in it, and getting a space. So it's sort of a kind of reverse process. So there's some senses in which it succeeds at being an inverse, but also some senses in which it fails. So if you start with a groupoid G and you form this Eilenberg-MacLane space out of it, this space does indeed have G as its fundamental groupoid, at least up to equivalence. You get, of course, a much larger groupoid because there are many more paths in this in this space that's built up out of simplices than there were paths that fall along the edges. But up to equivalence, you get back G. But you don't get all possible spaces this way. The Eilenberg-MacLane space of G is a special kind of space. It's what I'll just use this term in this way. Other people may use it in somewhat different ways. I'll call it a homotopy one type. So I mean, it's a very nice space. It's a CW complex. Here I'm saying it's a cell complex, which is a weaker statement. Doesn't really matter much for our purposes. A cell complex is just something that you can get by gluing balls together. A CW complex, you have to glue the higher dimensional balls onto the lower dimensional ones. Anyway, this is in fact a CW complex. So it's a nice space. In other words, it's not some horrible topological space like the rational numbers that's, for example, not discrete, but still there are no interesting paths in it. It's not one of these horrible fractally kind of nasty spaces. It's very locally well behaved. But more importantly, the one type business means that all its homotopy groups above the first vanish. So it has trivial pi 2, pi 3, and so on. And in fact, these two facts, that it's a cell complex and and its higher homotopy groups vanish, I guess three facts. Those higher homotopy groups vanish, and its first and its fundamental groupoid is G. Those characterize it up to homotopy equivalence. So any space that satisfied those three properties would be homotopy equivalent to this Eilenberg-MacLane space. So if you learn that stuff, then you can see the extent to which we do have an equivalence of two categories here. So first of all, I should say that this Eilenberg-MacLane construction, it really does give us a two-functor going back the other way. So it does something not just for groupoids, but also for functors between groupoids. It turns them into maps in an obvious way. You just draw a few pictures, you'll see. And similarly, natural transformations will give us homotopies between maps. And so then you try the trick of going there and back again and seeing if you're the same person when you're done. And you see that if you start with your groupoid, turn it into a space, and then calculate its fundamental groupoid, I've claimed that we get back an equivalent groupoid. And there is clearly also a map from our original groupoid into this one that's really sort of like a unit of an adjunction. So in other words, any morphism in our groupoid actually does turn into a path in this space that we built up out of all those simplices. And we also have a kind of comparison map going the other way. We take our space, work out its fundamental groupoid, and then take that groupoid and turn it back into a space. We get a much bigger space, but there's a map from that much bigger space down to our original space. And this will be a homotopy equivalence only if X is a homotopy one type. So if X had higher homotopy groups, this process of of calculating its fundamental groupoid would lose that information, and then you'd get back a space that had no higher homotopy groups. So it's not an equivalence. So certainly this is not any kind of equivalence, but of course that's not what we wanted. We shouldn't expect that mere groupoids are able to capture everything that's going on in topology. The homotopy hypothesis says that infinity groupoids are able to do that job. But you can kind of show a baby version of the homotopy hypothesis, a dimension one version. If you take top and you cut it down to a smaller two category, which I'll call one type, so that will consist of spaces that are homotopy one types in the sense that I've defined, maps between those, and homotopy classes of homotopies between such maps, then in this case, this fundamental groupoid two functor is an equivalence of two categories. So someone must have proved this ages ago. It just seems like they've had to have, but I wasn't able to find it anywhere. So I reluctantly may have been the one to prove it, which is a little unsatisfactory because I just sort of was scribbling off enough of a proof to convince myself that it was true before giving this lecture. And I really wanted it to someone to tell me that in fact we have a kind of two adjunction, like a two categorical adjunction between these two categories, namely that there's a nice relationship between these two functors going back and forth. If you're an old-fashioned Australian like Steve, you'd call this a pseudo adjunction, but I guess that's modern American sorts call it a two-adjunction, and you just assume that you mean the weakest possible notion of such a thing. Although these are strict two categories here. When I say n category in this talk, I usually mean the weakest possible kind of n category, but I also mean that I don't really know what definition I'm using, and the homotopy hypothesis is supposed to sort of be a test as to what are the good definitions. So this talk is, in general, quite vague in that way, but at the level of two categories, you have the capability of being very precise, and so I'm just shocked that nobody has proved that yet. It seems like sort of the whole point of the fundamental groupoid idea, but anyway. So that one-dimensional baby version of the homotopy hypothesis may let us boldly conjecture higher-dimensional analogs, so if we had a theory of weak n groupoids, and again the weak will be implicit from now on, we could formulate an n-dimensional version which said that there's an equivalence between n plus 1 categories, which I'll call the fundamental n groupoid n plus 1 functor, going between from n type to n groupoid. I guess in this conference we pronounce words that have no vowels like st and mgupid. So, I mean, if we can't do that, how can we possibly figure out infinity categories? So a homotopy n-type would be a cell complex whose homotopy groups above the nth vanish for any choice of base point. An n-type would be, if we could understand n categories well enough, it would be an n plus 1 category with these homotopy n-types as objects. Continuous maps between them is one morphisms, homotopies between those is two morphisms, and so on and so on and so on until you get to the n plus first level where you take homotopy classes of homotopies between homotopies, da-da-da-da. And so you notice there's the shift of plus 1 going on here, which is the same shift, just that cat is a two category, n cat is an n plus 1 category, so these are both n plus 1 categories. And so we would like some statement like this to be made precise and true, and so this is kind of a challenge laid down by Grothendieck to the future, saying that when you think you understand n categories, you should be able to make this precise and prove it. And in fact, he stated an infinity version, an infinite dimensional version of this hypothesis, which presumably would imply all the lower dimensional ones, if everything was in working order. He says there's an equivalence of infinity categories, pi infinity, from infinity types to infinity groupoids. Usually people don't call them infinity types, they usually just call them homotopy types. So those would be basically nice spaces, cell complexes. So infinity type will be my name for the infinity category with these nice spaces, for example, CW complexes or cell complexes as objects. Maps between those as one morphisms, homotopies between those as two morphisms, and so on ad infinitum. And now, because you're not imposing a dimensional cutoff, you never need to say homotopy classes. That's the idea of the true goal of n-category theory, is never say equal, so you never impose equivalence relations on things to make things equal. Now, there's some things that make this hypothesis a little bit easier to tackle than you might at first think, because both infinity type and infinity groupoid are not just arbitrary infinity categories, they're very nice in a certain way. They're what I'll call, and what other people sometimes call, infinity comma one categories. They're infinity categories, but where all the morphisms, all the J morphisms, are invertible weakly above J equals one. So in other words, continuous maps aren't invertible in general, of course. Those are the one morphisms. But homotopies between continuous maps are weakly invertible. If you have a homotopy from F to G, there's a reverse homotopy going back from G to F. And homotopies between homotopies are, again, weakly invertible, and so on. So it turns out that there's a large class of infinity categories that have this property, that everything is invertible above the first level. Of course, that's just a slight generalization of infinity groupoids, where everything is invertible. So we really don't need to know about infinity categories to tackle the homotopy hypothesis. We really just need to know about infinity one categories. Now you might think, oh great, how does that help? But the point is that there are actually lots of definitions around already of infinity one categories, which have developed a lot of machinery to work with them. So some of these definitions of infinity one category come from a definition of infinity category. You just say, I know what an infinity category is, and so an infinity one category would be a special one of those. So for example, Street and some of his co-workers now have a definition of an infinity category as a specially nice kind of simplicial set, a simplicial set with extra properties. I'll just call that a simplicial infinity category. A special case of those are the infinity one categories defined simplicially, and those are now, by André Girard, called quasi-categories. So quasi-categories are a special case of Street simplicial infinity categories. However, there are also lots of infinity one category definitions that are sort of standalone, meaning not coming, at least not yet necessarily, from a definition of infinity category. The simplest, in a sense, are the simplicially enriched categories. So these have been studied by topologists for quite a while. So these are categories enriched over the category of simplicial sets. So that just means that instead of a mere set of morphisms from one object to another, we have a simplicial set of morphisms. So in case you don't know how to think about that, well, there are lots of ways to think about that. So if you just had a set of morphisms, of course you'd have arrows like this, but we have a simplicial set. So in addition to having zero cells, that is the arrows themselves, we'd also have one cells, that is one-dimensional things in our HOM. And so you could think of those as like homotopies between arrows. So this is supposed to be a sort of an edge worth of arrows. And then you could also have, say, a triangle's worth of arrows. I'm trying to draw in perspective here now. You could have triangles of arrows and so on. And that would be a way of capturing notion of homotopies and higher homotopies between morphisms. So technically, a category enriched over simplicial sets, as many of you know, would just be that we have a simplicial set of arrows between any objects, and then composition is a map of simplicial sets, and the unit is a map of simplicial sets, and then all the rest of the category axioms hold as usual, strictly. There's also something called A-infinity categories, which are like simplicially enriched categories, but where all the category axioms hold up to homotopy, which satisfy, and those homotopies satisfy some further things up to homotopy, and so on. This A-infinity idea goes back to Stasheff's work on A-infinity spaces, where you have a product that's associative up to homotopy that satisfies a pentagon equation up to a homotopy, and so on. And then there's another approach called Siegel categories, and there are probably many more. And in fact, Julie Bergner is going to talk tomorrow about comparing different approaches to infinity one categories. And so you'll learn about those in more detail, hopefully, tomorrow. So any one of these approaches to infinity one categories is a possible framework in which you can state and prove the homotopy hypothesis. And in fact, in a certain sense, it's already been done in some of these. But I'll warn you that the things that are already been done don't really do as much for you as you might like. So I don't know if I really believe this principle in general, no pain, no gain. In fact, usually I seem to act as if the exact opposite were true. I try to avoid pain in general, but which is why I don't do certain kinds of mathematics, actually. But I guess it's a good principle to tell other people. And so that's what I'm doing. So one other thing I wanted to mention about this, I'll try to explain why the easy approaches don't quite do what everything we want, but I want to describe those easy approaches. I want to emphasize that while quasi-categories are a special case of street simplicial infinity categories, a lot more is known about quasi-categories than about the more general concept. So even though it's not a standalone definition, much more is known about it in a standalone kind of way than as part of a bigger definition of infinity category in general. So similarly, I should, in addition to trying to understand what are the different approaches to infinity categories we could use, the homotopy hypothesis mentions infinity groupoids, so we have to think a little bit about all the choices of definition there. Well, any definition of infinity one category should give you a definition of infinity groupoid as a special case, because in an infinity groupoid, all the morphisms of all dimensions are invertible, not just above dimension one. In particular, for example, quasi-categories have so-called con-complexes as the infinity groupoid special case. And again, history is sort of backwards. The con-complexes were developed before the quasi-categories. And the con-complexes are simpler to understand. So a con-complex, for those who haven't known this forever, is a simplicial set where every so-called horn has a filler. So a horn is just a simplex with one face missing and also its body missing. So it looks like a horn in the three-dimensional case. Here's a two-dimensional horn. Just this stuff here is the horn. And when we say it has a filler, what we mean is that given this data in our simplicial set, there exists a two-simplex filling it in, having those two edges as two of its boundaries. And then the idea is that in that situation, we can say that this new edge here, H, is a composite of the morphisms F and G. So it's a very weak notion of N category going on here, where we don't even speak of the composite of two morphisms, but just a composite. And it turns out that everything works out very beautifully that way, in particular because you're not saying the composite, but merely a composite. You don't need to explicitly list all those horrible coherence laws that show up in the definition of N category in some other approaches. Here they're all implicit, in fact. But notice also that because I'm saying that every horn has a filler, it'll also be true that if you view the triangle from some other perspective and remove some other face, it will still have a filler. So notice here I've drawn it so that the sort of the backbone of the triangle are these two guys here, but it's really this guy and this guy pointing backwards that are present in the horn. And so when I say that this horn has a filler, what I'm asserting is that I can form something which is sort of a representative of F followed by G inverse. So when we demand that every horn has a filler, we're really demanding that everything has inverses as well as that we can multiply things. And so Kahn complexes are not giving us a definition of infinity category, they're giving us a definition of infinity groupoid. And the tricky part really is to pick out which horns demand a notion of inverse. So it's much trickier to come up with a definition of quasi-category or simplicial infinity category using this approach, because you have to say, oh, I only want certain horns to have fillers. But Kahn complexes are nice and simple. You just say that every horn has a filler. So those have been around for ages, and I claim that that's a perfectly good definition of infinity groupoid. So let's try that. So if we take Kahn complexes as our definition of infinity groupoids, then it's really easy to define this thing I was calling pi infinity, a thing that would turn infinity types or homotopy types into infinity groupoids. In fact, you can define it as an ordinary functor between categories, and this has been done a long time ago. People usually speak of the adjunction between topological spaces and simplicial sets, where any topological space has this singular simplicial set associated to it, where you just look at all possible ways of sticking simplices, mapping simplices in a continuous way into your space, and get the simplicial set of all of them. And then conversely, any simplicial set can be geometrically realized to form a topological space. So this kind of adjunction is very closely related to the homotopy hypothesis, which is, again, remember, supposed to be relating topological spaces to infinity groupoids, or at least infinity homotopy types to infinity groupoids. And in a sense, the model categories were developed to handle this kind of situation, to understand the sense in which these two categories here are, quote, the same. So luckily, Mike Shulman has explained model categories in a beautiful way last night, so that even if you didn't understand them yesterday morning, now you do. And so you'll understand this stuff that I'm saying, hopefully. So model categories are a little complicated looking when you first meet them, but they have exactly the kind of structure that we need here. Model categories have these very nice objects in them, objects that are so-called fibrant and cofibrant. They're the ones for which homotopies are very well behaved. And in the category of topological spaces, cell complexes will be examples of, sorry, this is a typo here, cell complexes are examples of very nice objects in top. And it just got switched. And Kahn complexes are precisely the very nice objects in the category of simplicial sets. A model category also has this concept of weak equivalence, and you demand that every object be weakly equivalent to one of these very nice ones. And so it will be true that every topological space is weakly equivalent to one of these fibrant and cofibrant ones. In fact, it will be weakly equivalent to a cell complex. And every simplicial set is weakly equivalent to a Kahn complex. And then that lets you do various things. In particular, what it lets you do, at least in in principle, is it lets you build an infinity one category from a model category. So what you do is you take the very nice objects, that is the fibrin and cofibrin ones, and the morphisms between them, and then the homotopies between those, which is a concept that you can define in a model category, and then the homotopies between those as your two morphisms, and so on ad infinitum. So if you're an n-category theorist who's wondering what the heck model categories are, as long as you don't tell a topologist this, you're allowed to think model categories are just some sneaky trick for getting a hold of infinity one categories without ever saying anything more than not even saying the word two category or three category, much less infinity category. So in particular, the model category top gives us, by this hoped-for construction, the infinity one category that we're after of homotopy types, because the very nice objects there we could take them to be the cell complexes, if we like. Every space is weakly equivalent to one of those. And the model category of simplicial sets would give us infinity groupoid that way. Of course, when I say that they are a trick for getting infinity one category, whether you can do that at present or not depends on which definition of infinity one category you're using. So some have been more developed than others. As I said, the simplest definition of infinity one category, in a certain sense, and certainly the one that's been studied the most, is this concept of a simplicially enriched category. And so already back in 1980, Dwyer and Kahn came up with a recipe for getting a simplicially enriched category from a model category, which they call their simplicial localization of a model category. So the idea, they in fact gave a number of equivalent constructions of this simplicially enriched category from a model category in a series of papers. So I don't actually want to describe any of those constructions right now, but I'll just remind you that the idea that you're seeking is that you'd like to not only be able to talk about the morphisms between objects, but also edges of morphisms and triangles of morphisms and so on, and you should be able to figure out how to define that in a context where you can do homotopy theory. And a model category isn't precisely a context for doing homotopy theory. So it should come as no surprise that they were able to do this, and in fact in a number of different ways. And the nice thing about their simplicial localization idea is that you can define it using only the very nice objects, the morphisms between those, and the weak equivalences. They have a clever way of defining it using just that beta. But to prove lots of nice things about it, it helps to have a model category. So that's part of the story. We can get an infinity one category from top and an infinity one category from simplicial sets, but the homotopy hypothesis claims that those are equivalent. And that's where the concept of equivalence of model categories comes in. Quillen, who invented model categories, invented this notion of equivalence. And if you're an n-category theorist, you can think to yourself, Quillen equivalences are just a trick for getting equivalences between infinity one categories, those that you get from model categories. In particular, Quillen showed that top and simplicial set were Quillen equivalent by means of this adjunction here. Mike said a little bit more precisely what a Quillen equivalence was. I mean, he said completely precisely what it was. And Dwyer and Kahn showed that if you have Quillen equivalent model categories, then the simplicially enriched categories you get from them will be weakly equivalent. So notice now we're here, we need a notion of equivalence of these simplicially enriched categories, which is also called weak equivalence. And there's some subtlety lurking in that, but I don't think I'll go into that right now. So anyway, you could say that in some sense, by 1980, the homotopy hypothesis was proved, that we have a purely combinatorial way of studying homotopy types, a purely combinatorial way of defining infinity one categories, namely simplicially enriched categories, and construct and a construction of an equivalence between an infinity one category of coming from spaces and an infinity one category coming from simplicial sets. So in some sense, we know that the homotopy hypothesis is true. And so why are we still talking about it now? Well, now there are a lot of new approaches to N categories, and each one of them has its own homotopy hypothesis, so to speak. But we should ask, why bother with these new approaches? So why not just use the simplicial methods that homotopy theorists have been perfecting for the last 30 or so years or more? Why not just forget about these globular N categories that category theorists are enamored with? So one answer is, well, we always wanted to do globular N categories. We shouldn't stop just because those homotopy theorists prefer a different kind of shape. But that's not a really good answer. A better answer, somewhat better answer, is that, in fact, globular methods, this other approach to N categories, really does clarify, or at least has the potential for clarifying, the structure of infinity categories, and thus, in particular, infinity groupoids. And therefore, it'll give us some new insight into homotopy types if the homotopy hypothesis can be established in this globular approach. So I want to try to explain why I think that's true. It's something that people have known for quite a while, but it still bears repeating. So the globular approach to N categories has been developed recently. And in Batanin's approach, which has been refined by various people subsequently, the idea is that you can look for what I'll borrow Jim Dolan's notation and call these things cell colonies. You can look for certain arrangements of cells in your infinity category, or N category if you prefer, and then try to compose them. And so the most obvious way to try to compose all this stuff would be to glom it all together and just get one big fat three cell coming out. So that this would compose down to give this. But there's some subtlety involved. But the rough idea is actually fairly simple. The idea is that for every cell colony, we want to have an operation which is a composition operation, which allows us to compose a cell colony of that shape. Sorry, for every shape of cell colony, let's say, there's an operation that lets us compose it and get a cell of the maximal dimension in that colony. But then what about the laws that govern those operations? Well, it turns out that you just sort of throw in all the possible laws you can, but you throw them in not as equations, of course, that would be terrible, but throw them in as new operations that generate higher dimensional cells. So, for example, besides being able to compose all these cells in one fell swoop like that, we could also, say, compose these two cells, because that's a little cell colony in its own, right? Then compose these, and then sort of horizontally compose the results. That would be another way to get a cell of this same dimension. And we don't demand that those are equal. We don't demand that that result is equal to the result we got from doing it in one fell swoop. Instead, what we demand is that there's an operation that gives rise to a four cell going from one to the other, going from one way of composing things to another. So what we do is we just throw in a whole bunch of new operations as the substitute for equations, and those new operations generate cells of one dimension higher. Then you ask, well, what do those operations satisfy? And you say, well, same thing. We just make up a whole bunch of new operations going between those. I'm getting a little vague here. I would, of course, need to introduce lots of terminology to make this more precise. But the idea is, whenever there's a potential for a law between operations, throw in a new operation going from one to the other instead of an equation. And so he systematically does that and gets what you call a contractible globular operad, and that's just a gizmo that has all these operations. So that's the rough idea, and in low dimensions it's very simple, of course, and it matches the kind of thing we're used to. So for example, if you have a cell colony like this of two 1 cells or two 1 morphisms next to each other in an N category, you can compose them and get a new 1 morphism. Then of course, if you have 3 in a row, you could compose the first two or the last two first. So there's a couple of different things you could get, at least two. But then you have a new operation that generates a 2 cell going from one to the other called the associator. If you're just in a 1 category, that 2 cell has to be thought of as an equation, so you get the associativity law. So anyway, in any N category, you have this operation that composes 1 morphisms, and in a 1 category, that's really all you need to worry about. But in general, for any pointed N groupoid, that is an N groupoid with a special object, so let's think about this object as being the same each time, you get a way of composing loops, composing morphisms from that object to itself. And if you think of this from the point of view of homotopy theory, those loops are giving us elements of the fundamental group of the space that corresponds to this N groupoid. So this little cell colony here is just giving us multiplication in the fundamental group. And the nice thing is that in the one-dimensional case, that's sort of all there is. In other words, if you think about connected one groupoids, that is, one groupoids where every object is equivalent to this chosen one, then all there is to them is their fundamental group. That's sort of the one-dimensional case of the homotopy hypothesis as described before. Or if you're a topologist, you might say pi 1 classifies connected homotopy 1 types. So the idea here is that we're analyzing the one-dimensional homotopy hypothesis in a little bit more detail now than I was in my previous discussion of it by noticing that to classify homotopy 1 types, the main thing you need to focus on is this one particular operation corresponding to the only cell colony that gives us really interesting one morphisms. Of course, there are other cell colonies that give us one morphisms, but somehow or other they're not interesting because they're built up from this one. So what if we go to higher dimensions? Well, so in two dimensions, if we look for cell colonies that give us interesting two morphisms, there are more of them. So we can, this is the sort of obvious one, we can compose vertically a couple of two morphisms and we get a two morphism. But there are others. We can, as they call it, whisker a two morphism by a one morphism and get a two morphism. And of course, as I said, this gives you the associator, which in a two category, a weak two category, is something really interesting. It's not just the associativity equation anymore. It's the two morphism going between two different operations that you can get out of this cell colony. And these three fellows here, they're really all there is to two-dimensional homotopy theory. In other words, for starters, if you have any pointed N groupoid, what these operations give you is, first of all, this gives you the multiplication in the second homotopy group of your N groupoid, or if you prefer to think of it as a space, the second homotopy group of your space. You can define the homotopy groups for N groupoids just as you can for spaces, so I'm not going to draw a big distinction there. Here, you're getting an action of pi 1 on pi 2 out of that operation, and you also get an operation that from three elements of pi 1 give you an element of pi 2. And in fact, that satisfies a certain equation that makes you call it a cocycle. So here we have this group acting on this group, and we have group cohomology, the three cocycles with one group valued in the other. And it turns out that the pentagon equation for the associator is exactly the equation that says that we're getting a three co-cycle here. If you don't know about group cohomology and you know about N categories are the best way to understand what's going on in group cohomology as far as I'm concerned. So the Pentagon equation, that's what's giving us this thing that group cohomologists call the three co-cycle condition. And it turns out that if you have a homotopy 2 type, or in other words, well, since I'm working with this chosen base point, let's say a connected homotopy 2 type, or if you prefer to be algebraic, a connected 2 groupoid, this is really all there is. These classify connected 2 groupoids up to equivalence. I guess this goes back to a student of Grothendieck's that everyone calls Madame Sin. I don't know why they always call her Madame, but it's something sexist about that. No one says Monsieur Grothendieck, but anyway, if you look in any textbook, you'll see Madame Sin constructed this cohomology class associated to a two group, or more generally a two groupoid, with a chosen point, and classified them up to equivalence by means of this data. So pi 1, pi 2, the action and the cohomology class. And so we can really, by this globular approach to N groupoids, get a kind of classification or detailed understanding, at least, of N groupoids, at least up to dimension 2. What about dimension 3 and higher? Well, in dimension 3, you get more different cell colonies, which give us interesting 3 morphisms. So, of course, you can compose 3 morphisms. That should give us multiplication in pi 3. You can whisker a 3 morphism by a 1 morphism and get a new 3 morphism. That gives us the action of pi 1 on pi 3. But there's some interesting new things that go on. As has been pointed out repeatedly in the discussion of gray categories, which are an approach to 3 categories, this kind of cell colony here gives you an interesting 3 morphism, because there are 2 different ways to extract a 2 morphism out of it, and then by what I said, we get a 3 morphism going between those 2. So you could parse it in 2 different ways. You could say, first do this whiskering, and then do this whiskering, and then do this vertical composite, or you could do the other thing. Somehow this reminds me of the astrological symbol for Pisces or something. But you could also do that, or either that or some really funky eyeglasses or something. So you have these 2 things, and in a 2 category they're equal, but in a general weak 3 category you get a chosen 3 cell between them. And it turns out that in the special case of a special kind of 3 category should be a braided monoidal category, and then that gives you the braiding. So I said 1 morphisms, but I really meant to say 2 morphisms. These 2 morphisms are the data, and they're giving us a 3 morphism as the result. So that's a typo. That should be a 2. But we also get further things. So we have an associator for 2 morphisms, which will now be a 3 morphism. And we have... So the associator had been natural in the 2 category case, but in the 3 category case, it should in general be pseudo-natural, so that, in other words, how the associator changes when you apply a 2 morphism to any one of its arguments should give us a 3 morphism. I just drew for the first argument here. And also, we get the Stasheff pentagon from a list of 4 composable morphisms, but we get it not as an equation, but as a 3 morphism, which I like to call the pentagonator. So these are some of the cell colonies that are giving us really interesting 3 morphisms, and I'm not even 100% sure that I've gotten all of them, and I don't actually know the beautiful statement that I hope exists that would be like the statement I gave in lower dimensions, where I give you exactly what data it takes to completely classify connected 3 groupoids the way here we're classifying the connected 2 groupoids. I hope somebody knows that. Maybe Simona will explain this all in her talk next about homotopy 3 types. but I won't feel too disappointed if she doesn't completely classify tree groupoids for us. But I want someone to do it. So how can we proceed? And how about, of course, even for higher n? So I should warn you that most homotopy theorists have decided that this stuff is a hopeless morass that they would prefer to stay out of. And they've been very successful in getting interesting information without sinking into this swamp of trying to classify all homotopy types. And they're not dumb, so maybe we should be careful. But nonetheless, I have a feeling that globular N categories can help us organize the incredibly complicated algebraic data hiding in an N groupoid in a somewhat comprehensible way, in a way that you can sort of list it all out. And in particular, James Dolan and Ross Street have been working on this kind of thing and really have a theory, at least within some limited cases, that points out which kinds of cell colonies give interesting operations. And so they have a theory of globoplexes that they're working on that may shed some light on this. But one should also point out that this stuff is not just good for the hopeless task of classifying homotopy types. Any infinity category will have lots of infinity groupoids in it, and if the homotopy hypothesis is true, those correspond to homotopy types. And so you could use homotopy theory to study general infinity categories. For example, all the eighters that people like to talk about in infinity category theory, all the associators and braidings and solepses and pentagonators and things, all of those are equivalences. All those coherence law data are equivalents. So they're all living inside little infinity groupoids that are sitting inside our infinity category. And so they're really living inside homotopy types if the homotopy hypothesis is true. So you should be able to use homotopy theory to study them and comprehend them. So in short, even if the homotopy hypothesis doesn't really help people do homotopy theory, it's already helped us think about n-category theory, and it should keep on doing that. Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's right. Right, so he's proved a version of the homotopy hypothesis in his formalism. And I should point out that my talk wasn't at all meant to cover all the various attempts that people have made to prove the homotopy hypothesis. And I should have also mentioned that Eugenia Chang in her talk this afternoon will discuss one of those attempts, the work that's been done on trying to understand the homotopy hypothesis in the Batanin framework that I was very roughly sketching here. So it's a very complicated situation how the different approaches are doing on getting close to proving the homotopy hypothesis, and so I didn't want to try to cover all those. It's very hard to know exactly what he did in Pursuing Stacks. I know there's a recipe for kimchi near the end of Pursuing Stacks, but I sort of skipped some of the intervening 600 pages, so it's a little tough. Yeah?
So, you don't want to talk about it now, but I'm sort of curious about a weak equivalence between a
Okay. Okay, great. Then I'm off the hook. It's defined in a very typical homotopy theoretic way, yeah. Tom.
Okay, so I've got two questions. The first one, where have the unitators gone? You talked about associations in the last few pages.
Right. Well, no, they certainly don't figure. So it's good to talk about some context where we can do everything precisely, and this is a good one. Yeah, they don't figure. So, a version of this result is actually shows up in my paper with Aaron Lauda on two groups. That's a place where you can actually read all the details instead of having to like dig into some library in Paris and find her thesis. But so one step is to show that every two-group void is equivalent to one, where those left and right unitors are identities.
Right.
So there's this business of strictification, of making certain aiders the identity, and then others can't be. So as you know, Joyal and Koch make the unitors carry all the work of the weakness, and they make the associator strict. So there's a sort of like squashing the air out of an air mattress, right? But what we do is we squeeze out all the flab out of the unitors, and so the only thing left is the associator. And we also pick a skeletal version of our two groupoid so that if we pick a base point, we actually get a group of one morphisms. Yeah.
So I just think, adjunction
or something? Yeah.
Now, so if
I didn't say for sure that it was an adjunction, right?
Yeah,
that's a right. I didn't say for sure that it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm preparing for the crushing blow. Okay.
If that's the case, then Pi 1, being the right hand thing, ought to preserve monics in some suitable manner, because that's what right hand monics do. But it doesn't, because if you think of, say, the inclusion of the circle at the boundary of a 2-bit, then that monic that is image under Pi 1 is essentially
I'll have to think about that, and I mean, one really needs to think about the fact that I'd need to think about that. I mean, the monic means some kind of weakly monic in this case. Because the two morphisms are these homotopy classes of homotopies, and they would figure crucially in the definition of weakly monic. And just because it looks monic at the level of points doesn't instantly imply that it's pseudo-monic in that sense.
Okay, but
you should probably ask Steve. He seems to know what's going on better than I do.
If you want to do this for arbitrary n, then 250 pi n equals 0, which should be an adjunction between top and left with pi north on the right. And
right, but notice to build my 0 category out of top, I should take the very nice topological spaces as objects, but as objects mod. I mean, there's always this dimensional truncation that goes on, right? So you take spaces, maps, homotopies between them, and then homotopy classes at the top level. So now your top level, you're pushing the top level to be all the way down to the zeroth level. You're making top be a one category?
I'm looking for one adjunction.
Oh, or sorry.
One category.
That's right. So the morphisms would be homotopy classes of maps. So you're taking topological spaces and homotopy classes of maps on this side to make this a one category. And you're taking sets and functions. And I'd have to think again about whether that somehow saves the day and gets around the problem you're raising. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah? Gee, I could have paid for you to ask that question. So you knew that I wanted to actually talk about that, right? Right. Okay, I paid you to give the answer too. So, yeah. So, okay, you get extra beer tonight. Yeah. So the sort of idea that you can get from the homotopia hypothesis is maybe there's some kind of enhanced version of topological spaces which corresponds to N categories. And people are already nibbling around the corners of this idea because there's a subject being born called directed algebraic topology, where you think of, for example, the unit interval as having a direction, and perhaps think of your topological spaces as having something like a partial ordering on it, although they're busy arguing exactly what the correct definition should be. And then a map from the interval into the space would only be allowed if it was always moving in the direction of increasing order. So in that context, the path would not necessarily have an inverse. And so instead of getting a fundamental groupoid out of such a space, you'd get a fundamental category. And what you'd really like, of course, would be able to do a lot of things in that subject that mimic ordinary topology, but with categories and N categories replacing groupoids and N groupoids. So it hasn't really reached the point of doing all the things it should, but you'd like, for example, to be able to have like the classifying the Eilenberg-MacLane space of a category work out to be a, you know, an example of one of these directed spaces and so on. Yeah?
Can you just comment on that? This whole subject has entirely been motivated so far, not by categorical considerations, but by pure science applications and current considerations.
That's largely true, although I should emphasize that Marco Grandis has been doing some work on this subject that's very heavily motivated by category theory. It's very, right, yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I think also there's interesting stuff about relation of stratified spaces to this subject and a lot of things which we have discussed already, as you know. So I think there's a lot to be done there. Okay, let's have some coffee.